This is River to River. I'm Dean Borg, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. It's Politics Day, and there's a treasure of topics waiting. Political science professors Tim Hagel at the University of Iowa and Bruce Nesmith at Cole College will be analyzing the nuances of the federal sequestration dilemma and its effects on the political decision makers and you and me. Also, Iowa political issues, education reform, and the political scramble in the coming campaign season. Politics Day with Tim Hagel and Bruce Nesmith. River to River, right after the NPR News. Dean Borg with River to River, and we've got more topics than we can handle here today, and we're going to move right along introducing Bruce Nesmith, who is the Joan and Abbott Lipsky Professor of Political Science at Cole College. Hello.
Good afternoon, Dean.
And Tim Hagel's here, too. He's the Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Tim, hi.
Hey there.
Well, you've just heard on the NPR News all the dire news, and we've been hearing this for a long time. A year ago when it first That word first came out, sequestration. We didn't quite even know how to pronounce it, and I probably still can't. But it looks now as being portrayed as an impending tsunami. What do you think, Tim?
Well, certainly that's the way President Obama wanted to portray it yesterday in his speech, and you heard again, as you indicated on the news. But I don't think it's going to be quite that bad. Certainly there are going to be areas where they are going to have to make cuts, and there certainly will be certain types of cutbacks. But one person put it, it's like 5 cents on the dollar.
You referred to the president's speech.
Now, if Congress allows this meat cleaver approach to take place, it will jeopardize our military readiness. It will eviscerate job-creating investments in education and energy and medical research. It won't consider whether we're cutting some bloated program that has outlived its usefulness or a vital service that Americans depend on every single day. It doesn't make those distinctions. Emergency responders, like the ones who are here today, their ability to help communities respond to and recover from disasters will be degraded. Border Patrol agents will see their hours reduced. FBI agents will be furloughed. Federal prosecutors will have to close cases and let criminals go. Air traffic controllers and airport security will see cutbacks.
Bruce Nesmith, he was speaking, as he referred to there, the background of first responders, all uniformed. He has the bully pulpit on this, doesn't he?
This is what's known in the biz as the Washington Monument game, which is when you have impending cuts or shutdowns or something like that to put out the sexiest picture of things that are going to suffer. Obviously, there are going to be a lot of things that suffer, and I don't diminish the impacts that he describes. There are a lot of things that are going to suffer that people don't care about, but these are some photogenic things that people do care about.
Well, you said don't care about. Mm-hmm. The Pentagon is saying nearly 800,000 civilian workers forced to take one day of leave a week. Out here in the Midwest and across the country, you'd hardly find any tears about that, maybe.
It does sound, you know, the reputation of federal workers probably undeservedly is that they're overpaid and underworked. So I think, you know, the conventional wisdom is that won't affect public opinion.
Yeah, having worked in the federal government for a while, I know that particular reputation. And, you know, quite frankly, there are some federal workers that applies to, but there are a lot that don't. A lot of the folks I worked with in particular are very hardworking. And certainly when you're talking about the military, you don't like to hear about military cuts, even if it's the civilian employees in the military. But that's, to a certain extent, that's one of the problems when you're cutting budgets, is that sometimes they don't have a lot of flexibility in some of the larger projects, and it's actually personnel which tend to get cut first, and that can have certain effects going forward. But on the other hand, it's up to, as Bruce was saying, and we had talked before about the Washington Monument, or you had phrased it, firefighters first. that executives have that ability to move around money. So if they want to say, okay, these terrible things are going to happen, then to some extent that's the executive's choice as opposed to make the cuts in a way that's less destructive to either personnel or programs.
But in the president speaking yesterday and televised and all the trappings, as I just described, he's trying to communicate around Congress and directly with the American people to put pressure on Congress now in recess and back in their districts. And I wonder how effective is that going to be? Because there are going to be effects that I will feel. And maybe I'm not so tearful about, and I'm putting myself as a general person in society, not so tearful about 800,000 civilian workers being furloughed at the Pentagon. But I am going to be concerned about something that affects me directly, even though I may not know about it now, Bruce.
And that's hard to trace.
Is the president effective in going around Congress and speaking to the American people? And what are the I'll ask a sub question there too. And Tim, you can chime in. But Bruce, what are the Republican strengths?
Well, you know, I think the Republican strengths are that they're elected from districts that reflect conservative views. And so their conservative constituents are saying, you know, don't raise taxes, don't give in on spending cuts, let's do some cuts. And apparently, surprisingly to some people, are less bothered by the military cuts than I think originally was expected when this thing was designed a year and a half ago.
Now, I would agree with that. And one of the things that you see is that the idea behind the sequestration was supposed to be that both sides would be so abhorrent about cutting the particular area. Republicans don't want to cut defense. Democrats don't want to cut the rest of this stuff. But on the other hand, now both sides are maybe looking at it and saying, well, from the Democrats' point of view, we would like to cut defense, and maybe this is our only opportunity to do so. And from the Republicans' point of view, well, we'd like to cut the other programs, and this is our only opportunity to do so. But at the start of your question, Obama is sort of reaching out to the public, and he's basically in that campaign mode kind of a thing. And given the way he was criticizing Republicans, telling them you have to be balanced, you're not compromising, all these sorts of things, it doesn't seem that he's really reaching out to the Republicans. So some are speculating, well, maybe he really doesn't want a deal, but at least wants to place any blame for any hardships that result from the cuts on the Republicans in hopes of perhaps getting the House back for the Democrats in the 2014 elections.
Bruce, I said the president's going around Congress and going out to the American people, but Congress is on recess right now, and those members are back talking to their constituents. So maybe the president has to do that. Both are speaking with the president speaking broadly to the nation, and individual congressmen and senators speaking directly to their individual constituents.
I think, you know, the model, when I started teaching decades ago, they always talked about, you know, if you get these hysterical media stories that if Congress doesn't pass a budget by a certain date, then the government will shut down. And of course, the government never shuts down. And then in the 1990s, the government did shut down. And that really worked politically to the benefit of President Clinton and to the detriment of House Republicans. So there certainly is the expectation, maybe by both sides, that not reaching a solution can have political benefits and may it lead to a more pleasant solution for them, for their side down the road.
Speaking about the impasses, and there are many in Congress, in the Senate, the pending nomination, Tim Hagel, of Chuck Hagel.
Spelled differently.
Yes. I was just going to say Hagel. I hadn't realized that until I asked you that
question.
You're going
to say no relation.
Not your uncle.
No.
Okay. Chuck Hagel, a former senator from Nebraska, to be Secretary of Defense. Is it a done deal?
Well, maybe. It's not entirely clear that we're sort of in a holding pattern right now, given that the Republicans managed to block the nomination coming up for a vote. But several Republicans are sort of signaling that unless during this recess period that they find some additional information that's particularly damaging to Hagel, even some sort of anti-Israel statements or something else, that it's very likely that they would allow it to come up for a vote. Because Republicans generally have criticized attempts by Democrats to filibuster in the past. And so even though they are using the tactic, they're a little less comfortable with it. And so they would probably let it come up for a vote. And if it does come up for a vote, he'll undoubtedly pass.
But he may get to be Secretary of Defense, but is he politically wounded?
To a certain extent, yes, although that may not matter a whole lot. And some people are saying, well, what's the end game for the Republicans here? Is it just simply a matter of trying to bloody up a nominee of Obama? And there may be certain aspect along those lines, but it's also a way to perhaps keep, if he becomes Secretary of Defense, keep Hagel in line, although as many have suggested that because Obama is very hands-on in terms of some of these policy things, whether it's at state or defense or whatever, that Hagel may not be doing a whole lot of the ultimate policy making anyway.
Less than a month ago, going to another subject here, that is the cyber attacks that China is reportedly making on this nation's strategic areas, infrastructure and major defense contractors and so on. Less than a month ago, President Obama mentioned that in his State of the Union address.
We know foreign countries and companies swipe our corporate secrets. Now our enemies are also seeking the ability to sabotage our power grid, our financial institutions, our air traffic control systems. We cannot look back years from now and wonder why we did nothing in the face of real threats to our security and our economy.
Isn't, Bruce, this old news? There's a perpetual suspicion, I thought, about China's power and motives.
There's the smoking gun, or at least substantial evidence that they know where the building is, that there's pictures in yesterday's New York Times of the building where all this is supposedly going on. I have no idea how this gets solved, but I think it makes it compelling viewing, because historically our disputes with China have been overshadowed by the fact that we need China and China needs us. China owns a lot of our debt. We rely on China as a conduit to North Korea, since nobody else seems to talk to North Korea. There's a lot of ways in which China is vital to the U.S. in terms of international relations. And so we've always kind of overlooked human rights stuff and the suspicions and everything else because we need them more than we need to be enemies with them. And this seems to be almost – this is like the worst thing ever, or the worst thing yet that China's done. So mm-hmm. How we resolve this is going to be really interesting.
Before we go on in this, I want to give our phone number if you want to get involved in this conversation as we move from topic to topic. It's 866-780-9100. Again, 866-780-9100 is your direct line into our conversation here. And, Tim, you get kind of concerned here when it's also revealed that one of those targets is Lockheed Martin. Now, Lockheed Martin is the manufacturer of the new F-35 fighters for the Air Force, slight modifications for the Navy to put a hook on so they can land on a carrier, and the Marines, that F-35 is to be able to take off vertically. That is a very sophisticated new stealth fighter. Not coincidentally, the Chinese fighter, their new one, closely resembles the F-35 built in this country. And that gets to be kind of concerning, considering the billions of dollars we poured into the F-35.
Oh, absolutely. And given the amount of money that we spend on research and development for these sorts of things, if the Chinese or whomever can simply hack in and get that information online in some way, it saves them a lot of money and they get the advantages. And that's one of the things that, of course, going forward, we'll have to, we being the State Department or other aspects of the U.S. government, we'll have to use that as a talking point. And it's basically a new form of spying. In the old days, of course, you had to have a spy, somebody on the inside that was getting those documents and so forth. But now, because everything is online in one way or another, very sophisticated hackers can get that information, not necessarily easier, but at least they can have access to it. And our response, as Bruce was saying, is not entirely clear. And we don't have sort of a protocol in terms of saying, well, okay, well, this is just something that's an annoyance. Somebody comes in and has some link that causes trouble versus you're actually spying versus maybe you're shutting down the electrical grid.
Yes.
And, crippling the country or damaging the financial markets. And so there has to be some sort of ideas to where in sort of the cyber realm that we declare war of some sort. And then if we do, what do we do?
Before we get too far away from sequestration, I'm going to go back to that topic because Tom is calling from Des Moines, wants to ask a question. Go ahead, Tom.
Yes, I have not heard much in the way of compromise discussed about the whole of the sequestration. I was wondering whether your guests might think that a percentage of the sequestration, which I understand is about $85 billion at least for 1 year, whether that might be a suitable compromise that might be talked about behind the scenes, the Republicans presumably wanting a higher percentage, the Democrats a lower.
Tim Hagel?
Well,
I mean, it's Bruce Nesmith.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's easy for us to sit here in our warm booth in Iowa, but it just seems to me like there's compromises available, even better ones than that. I mean, just look at we've got a Democratic president, Democratic Senate that wants stuff. You've got a Republican House that wants stuff. You know, construct a bill out of that that gets both sides some of what they want, and you've got your compromise. So why isn't that happening? I think the answer is that there are incentives, and we talked about some of these already. There are political incentives, or at least perceived political incentives, on both sides not to reach a deal. So as reasonable as the caller's proposal is, I think the both sides feel that the incentives are not to do that, even that.
Let's go to Bob in Mount Pleasant who wants to. Bob, you've got a question?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I'm just wondering why all the talk we hear about cutting Social Security and Medicare benefits, and there's absolutely no talk about cutting tax deductions for people that can afford it.
Okay.
I would gladly give up all my tax deductions. Now, I'm making around $60,000 a year.
Bob, we've got the gist of your question, and I'm going to ask Tim Hagel. He is nodding his head that he has it. I'm going to take you off the air because of the quality of that line, Bob. Thanks for calling. Tim?
Yeah, I guess the first thing I would say before getting to your direct question is that if you're willing to give up your tax deductions, go ahead. You know, one of the things that that sort of irritated Republicans over the last year or 2 years in talking about this is a number of people like Warren Buffett and others who said, yeah, I'd be happy to pay taxes. Well, go ahead. There's nothing really stopping you from doing so. Now, to your actual question, even both Democrats and Republicans are wary about cutting benefits, Social Security or Medicaid, for current folks, although some Medicaid cuts were part of Obama's plan and Republicans were very quick to point that out and wanted to restore it. But certainly the idea is that something has to be done to reorganize it or restructure it, perhaps raise the retirement age, something of that nature, because those are the entitlements that are basically, as its phrase is sometimes used, bust the budget ultimately. And if they're not restructured, it's going to be very difficult. And certainly raising taxes on the rich, particularly the 1% that Obama often talks about, is not going to solve that particular problem.
We're going to move on now to Tom Vilsack saying he's not going to run for the Senate seat. But before we do, just want to note for our listeners that those calls came in on 866-780-9100. You can join the conversation too, 866-780-9100. And Bruce, former Iowa Governor, now U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack, says he's not running for Tom Harkin's Senate seat in a couple of years. Is that announcement by Vilsack, is it just a courtesy, or is it to clear the field for Congressman Bruce Braley's campaign fundraising? Who is receiving that message?
Probably donors and campaign donors and organizers and things like that, Vilsack fans who might have held out hope that he might run. There certainly are other people who have been talked about in terms of running for the seat, but nobody with the visibility that Braley has.
Mm-hmm. Any comment on that, Tim?
Well, one interesting thing about that is that in his conversation along those lines where he said he wasn't interested in the Senate seat and saying he's happy being Secretary of Agriculture, but he didn't suggest that he might – that he's basically saying no to possibly running for the governorship. But it's the same time frame. Both of those elections are in 2014. So if he's happy being Secretary of Agriculture – and doesn't want to run for the Senate, you would think that would apply for the governor's office too. But he basically said, well, you never say never. And so it sort of leaves that door open, I suppose.
What do either are you seeing in Republicans aligning themselves for that Harkin Senate seat?
You mean in terms of the people?
Yes,
or,
yes.
I've heard Steve King a lot. I've heard Tom Latham somewhat, and I think he might be a stronger statewide candidate.
The governor, Branstad, says outsiders should keep out of advising Steve King not to run.
Yeah. Then, of course, Karl Rove and his new group that's going to try to keep the Christine O'Donnell's out of Senate races. So that gets awkward.
Mm-hmm. We're going to be talking about the Iowa economy here in just a moment. Governor Branstad is on a recruiting trip now to California. Before he left him, he said that's a happy hunting ground for businesses wanting to move. Kim Reynolds, the lieutenant governor, heading for Vietnam on a trade development trip. Iowa has among the lowest unemployment rates in the nation. What's all that saying about the political climate here in Iowa for Republicans and Democrats and the Iowa economy?
Well, you know, I suppose you can make some political issue out of it, but it's one of the things where, you know, Iowa has done relatively well. Certainly, we've been hurt more than, unemployment particularly, that our unemployment's less than the national average, but we're always less than the national average. And we've always prided ourselves in education. Maybe we've fallen a bit there, but we're getting back in the game. Iowa workers are always known to be hardworking folks, and because of the tax and business climate here, that it seems reasonable to try to attract businesses here to keep unemployment low, keep people businesses, and hopefully, and sort of looking at it from the university's perspective, we're always concerned about the brain drain. And so if we can keep more of our workers here with good jobs, then that helps Iowa overall.
And Bruce, I was saying that Iowa's in relatively good shape. In fact, the state budget surplus is kind of a bone of contention between Republicans and Democrats, Republicans touting it as an accomplishment of the Branstad administration, and Democrats saying, well, it shouldn't be tucked in the mattress. Let's use it for projects for the public good. Whose story getting through to the voters on that?
I haven't seen polling, so maybe the callers could help us with that. I suspect that that people who say education to pick one, or the highway lobby might be another, dealt with substantial cuts over the last few years might see the Democratic message as more persuasive. Those of us who remember the perilous condition of the budget, despite relatively good fiscal management over the years. The recession was very scary,
Tim, just before we go to the break here, and that's coming up, there's a struggle over Medicaid expansion. Governor Branstad steadfastly opposing the federal government's offer to help pay for the expanding of Medicaid eligibility. Is Iowa's economy strong enough to support that argument, or are there people who say, hey, I want government health care, and I'm not going to be able to get it because you're arguing against me?
Well, that's a tough question, and the idea is again, that there's going to be a huge expansion in this, and it's one of those things that's called an unfunded mandate. And so Branstad's basically looked at this and said, well, we can't afford to do this, and we'll have to let the federal government handle that aspect of Obamacare.
I know we've got a number of callers on the line, and we're going to other topics right after the break, but we have news coming up. I'm Dean Borg, along with Bruce Nesmith and Tim Nagel, political scientists, and this is River to River on Iowa Public Radio, back in just a few minutes. Dean Borg continuing River to River now, and we have as guest today Bruce Nesmith, who's the Joan and Abbott Lipsky Professor of Political Science at Cole College, and Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. And we're taking your calls, too. In fact, we're going to take a call from Jan in Iowa City in just a few seconds, and I'll tell you that the number to call to get involved is 866-780 as we move quickly through these subjects. So I'm going to give you a preview of what we're going to be talking about here in this next half hour. And we'll be talking about education reform briefly, and then the casino referendum votes. Dennis Reese on the news just said that there's a news conference this afternoon in Warren County, and in Cedar Rapids it's going, and in Linn County, hot and heavy. We'll get into that a little bit. And then a little bit about academic freedom and the controversy surrounding Bruce Rastetter in an email to Sally Mason. So all of those topics are going to be coming up in this next half hour. But first, I promised we'd put Jen on the air, and she wants to talk about something that we were speaking about just before the break, and that is the expansion of Medicaid in Iowa. Jen, go ahead.
Yes. From having worked in a hospital setting, my recollection is that while IowaCare provides a safety net, Medicaid and IowaCare are not necessarily equivalent in the coverage they provide and the medical options that are available. And I was wondering if your guests could compare the two, and if there is a significance between the two, if they could say why quality of care is not more a part of the dialogue as we talk about shifting to coverage with Medicaid.
I'm going to let them contemplate that just for a little bit. I think, admittedly, they're not experts on those two programs, but I think philosophically they may have a comment or two, Jan. I'll just say for our listeners, I know that the Iowa Care program is newly created just a little bit, maybe in the past decade, by the Iowa legislature, and it replaces the old, what was called the Iowa Indigent Care Program, which was all patients coming from throughout Iowa who were indigent, unable to afford their care, to University of Iowa hospitals and clinics to receive their care. And that's why that network of hospital cars fanned out from Iowa City to bring people from their front door to the hospital in Iowa City and then back home again. That was that. Now, that has been replaced by Iowa Care, as you refer to it, and that involves only Broadlawns Hospital in Des Moines and the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, and only Polk County residents to Broadlawns in Des Moines. And others would come to university hospitals, and that is an indigent care program, but far scaled down from what that old indigent care program, what was called the state papers program, used to be. Now, philosophically, Bruce.
Well, you know, I think quality is an issue. So is access, and so is cost. And you know, what we've seen with the health care reform debate over the last couple of decades, culminating in the bill, which was passed in 2010 and which is being slowly implemented and takes, I think, full effect next year, is a concern about expanding access. But I think everybody has in the back of their mind, how are we going to pay for this? And I think that the cost concerns right now, particularly with the budget generally, but with healthcare inflation and everything else, cost concerns do tend to drown out quality of care concerns at this point, particularly for those who don't have access to care right now.
Any comment, Tim?
Just one other thing. The quality of care issue is something that seems to be coming up a bit in the with the implementation of various stages of Obamacare in that, and again, most people would say, well, we should have access to those who maybe don't have it in one way or another. You know, cost is certainly an issue. But what may come to pass is that people that have health care or more specifically insurance to cover their health care, that their quality of care may decline to a certain extent as costs get shifted around, as access gets shifted around, and that may cause a certain pushback in terms of the implementation of certain aspects of the program.
We're going to move on now to, and thank you, Jen, for that question from Iowa City and allowing us to clarify that, to education reform. Governor Branstad for the past 2 years proposing big changes in Iowa's K through 12 school system, some changes involving teacher qualifications and teacher pay, and that's where it gets sticky because you're involving then the teachers union, the ISEA in Iowa. They haven't been exactly, those proposals, sailing through the legislative process, so what are the politics, Bruce, as you look at it, of this education issue? In fact, the Iowa House, Republican-dominated, passed a scaled-back
right.
education reform bill this morning after debating till midnight last night.
And the big, I think one of the big changes was reducing the minimum salary of the original legislation called for a substantial increase in the minimum salary for teachers. And this one still has an increase, but it's not quite as substantial. I think, again, we're looking at issues of cost. How are we going to pay for all this? I'm not sure that people have philosophical objections to the changes so much as they have concerns about costs. And I think the other thing is how qualifications are measured. I think that's the one thing that teachers' unions are particularly concerned about.
Tim, politically, I've watched this, and I see the governor being conciliatory, not wanting to criticize the teachers' union whatsoever. But is it testing the strength of the teachers' union?
Well, I'm not sure that particular aspect is, but certainly there are aspects to the education question more generally that do create tensions between often government officials, usually Republican elected officials, and teachers' unions, and that, of course, teachers' unions want higher pay and often balk at certain types of either qualification enhancements or any kind of – I saw recent things where they want to get rid of standardized testing or things that would sort of help to determine the quality of teaching. And that's, of course, the concern for a lot of elected officials is that – and particularly here in Iowa – where I forget what the dates were, but a number of years ago we were number one under some scale for education, and now we're somewhere in the middle of the pack. And to bring that back up, you have to basically have some sort of determination, however it is, standardized tests or something, that indicates whether the students are actually learning what you want them to learn. And that's one of the things that's often very contentious in negotiating these things with teachers' unions.
And Stanley and Fayette, going to bring into our conversation here. Stanley, you've got a comment about financing schools.
Well, yes, with the financing of the schools, I never understood that schools are strapped for money, but yet the tax dollars are going to sports programs. Why don't they move them sports programs out of the schools completely and start educating the children? It shouldn't even be a part of the school. Do you look at Finland or Korea that's at the top of the list? Their sports are all outside the schools. They are not in the schools.
Thank you, Stanley. And that's a perennial comment that we get. And Tim, you're shaking your head yes.
Yeah, it's certainly a comment we get in the high schools and even probably the middle school. And to a certain extent, I think tradition has a lot to do with it. I can't say for sure about Finland and Korea with their how they develop, but certainly here the sports programs developed in the schools. And to some extent, now it's going to vary from sport to sport, but certainly some of the sports may actually pay for a good portion of their own costs. That's certainly true at the University of Iowa. People always attack about the salaries of coaches and football particularly. But then on the other hand, there's the notion of you want to have an athletic program of some sort. Now, maybe it may not be quite as organized as football and basketball and, you know, all these other sports, but the whole idea is that students are, with the obesity problem, that they're not getting enough exercise, and if phys ed programs in particular are cut and maybe sports programs along with them, then students are getting even less exercise than what they really need.
Well, he might argue, too, that it's a way of getting public interest and support into the public schools because that's for parent participation. There's nothing more involved than a parent with a child in sports. And let's go on now to the casino gambling question. We heard Dennis Reese saying just a few minutes ago that there's a news conference this afternoon in Warren County. In fact, we have a caller on the line from Norwalk. We'll bring him on in just a little bit. But a news conference there about a referendum coming up. They'd like to hold a referendum on whether or not to allow casino gambling in Warren County, which is just at the south edge of Des Moines. In Cedar Rapids, of course, Bruce, there's a May 5th. That was, I think, the vote for referendum in Linn County.
Yeah, March 5th.
Is 2 weeks from yesterday.
Yes.
And earlier this week, too, there was a revelation by that investors group about where they would like to locate that.
Right.
And that came after they were criticized roundly by the Just Vote No coalition about not revealing where they were going to build it, and there was secrecy. So I think they came out and said, this is where we want to build it. Now, there was a new commercial just this morning.
This land is your land. This land is my land.
But now, The Cedar Rapids City Council may be cutting a sweetheart deal to give our land away to millionaire developer and casino salesman Steve Gray. That's right. After weeks of secrecy, we're now told the Linn County Casino would be built on city property. So how much would investors pay for our city-owned land? It could be nothing. We don't know for sure because Steve Gray just won't say. There's more. To protect Gray's investment, a new flood wall would be built around the casino. Who would pay for that? Taxpayers? Tell Steve Gray that Cedar Rapids taxpayers deserve answers before the March 5th vote. No blank checks for backroom deals, no land giveaways to big developers. Vote no on the Linn County Casino.
Bruce, background us. What's going on here?
In a way, I kind of remember Tim and I sitting here last summer talking about Mitt Romney's tax returns and Democrats trying to smoke out the tax returns. And when some of them came out, they were demanding more information. And I think part of that is the hope that there's something in there that will change somebody's vote from yes to no. I'm not aware of much impact of the decision or of the revelation of where they'd like to site the casino. I think the people who were against it are still against it, and I think the people who were for it are still for it for the most part. And it is city land. There was hope right after the flood that this would be some sort of green space. I think that hope was a minority, an idealistic minority. I think the city was not going to keep this land anyway. And so, and it's not traditionally been city land. It's traditionally had industries and stuff built on it. So that's kind of a reach, I think.
But Tim, in the larger perspective, there's almost an epidemic of casino gambling in Iowa, and I'm not saying that derogatorily, but I'm saying everybody wants in on the action. And in Linn County, a lot of that vote no money is coming in from those who already have gambling establishments in Iowa. Riverside, south of Iowa City, has admitted, yep, we're pouring millions of dollars into that. The casino in Waterloo saying the same thing. The Native American casino, Meskwaki Casino, doesn't have to report what they're spending to the State Racing and Gaming Commission, as does the ones that I've already mentioned. But they also have said, we're against it, because there are gamblers, of course, going from Linn County out to those other places. So there's a lot at stake here. In fact, could Linn County voters say, hey, it's time for us to have some of the action stay out of our business, other counties?
Well, we certainly want a piece of the action, so to speak, which is, as I recall, a title of an old Star Trek episode. Just throw that in there. The problem is that there's only a certain market for it. And certainly if through advertising and so forth, you might get some additional customers. But at a certain point, you reach sort of the saturation point for these things. And if you get enough of them, then maybe some of them will start to fail. And as a result, then maybe smaller casinos or ones in I'm thinking Riverside, because it's a little bit more out of the way, that they could be very well in danger. And so by sort of voting to or helping to try to convince people that Linn County, for instance, shouldn't have one, that it helps to preserve their economic position.
And it's being sold. The pro-vote people are saying jobs, jobs, jobs. Let's bring Paul on from Norwalk. He's got a news conference down there. Paul, what's going on down there?
Well, I'm asking a question about a little earlier topic about education, and really it's a couple comments. One of them is to you, Dean. I always respect the way that you handle facts and try to find the information, but you allow one of your guests to say, you know, Iowa slipped on some scale into some percentage ranking. And that's what I hear constantly from Iowa Public Radio and see it in the paper all the time. Yet Iowa's number one in graduation rate, number two in the ACT scores. So, and it's admittedly, it's low on Michelle Rhee's organization, I forgot what it is, who rank states by who accepts their organization into the state.
Okay.
So could you make a comment on that about why, where are you? I mean, if you're not getting, if you don't have the information, please don't make the statement. If you don't have the if you don't have something solid to base it on, don't rank the state and education without any knowledge.
Tim Hagel has a comment for you, Paul, and I'm going to take you off the air because we're going to move on to the topic we're on right now. But Tim Hagel has a comment on that.
Yeah, I was the one that made that particular statement, so I just a quick response. And the reason that I said some scales, I wanted to, in fact, leave open the possibility that different people can measure things in different ways. And I have heard the same thing that you did, where we're very good in graduation rates, very good in other areas. I think it's the ACT scores. But for whatever reason, that there are other measures, whatever they happen to be. So you always have to be careful about these things. And no, I don't have right in front of me whatever particular study it was, but that's why I made the statement sort of vague to leave it open for other measures.
Paul, thanks for calling from Norwalk. I thought calling from Norwalk, where there's a gambling news conference today, that's what he wanted to talk about. But back to the casinos in Iowa. Do you see, Tim, that this is seeking economic development? Are rural communities, Linn County is not rural, of course, it's metropolitan, but desperate for jobs and revenue? Is this driving it?
Well, sure. And it's not just casinos, but that seems to be something that does bring in jobs and does bring in development, brings in money of various sorts. And so if this is a way that counties, whether they're rural or suburban or urban counties, if they can bring in jobs and money in this particular way, they certainly would do it. If they can bring in other types of, whether it's manufacturing or industrial or something, they would probably be able to do that too. But it's more difficult for those sorts of things if you don't have an infrastructure there, whereas if you're building a resort of some sort, and as long as you have access to good roads to get to, whether it's an interstate or a bigger metropolitan area, that you should be in pretty decent shape.
And we have a couple of posts here, a tweet from Gregory on this topic. He says the real question is, do we want a casino in Linn County? And that's a comment from Gregory. And then Adam also says, unfortunately, many voters in Linn County see this issue in a number of ways, the right to gamble and jobs and moralistic and things like that. He said the fact that money has been pumped into both sides of the issue is a primary cause of denigrating it into name-calling and finger-pointing instead of having a civil, intellectual discussion of the issue. So that's the comments from people who are commenting on the casino business. Okay, let's go on to academic freedom. And both you are experts on that, so I'm going to depend. And this comes up because the State Board of Regents President Pro Tem Bruce Restetter recently sent an email to University of Iowa President Sally Mason criticizing him, and I mean not criticize, asking for some information. That's the way that it's portrayed, and that's the way it seems to be that Bruce Restetter was asking that a favor from the president of the University of Iowa. And he was commenting on the work of UI professor of civil engineering and environmental engineering, Jerry Schnorr. In January, Professor Schnorr spoke at a conference in Washington, D.C., claiming that biofuel production raises large sustainability issues by taking too much water from aquifers in the production of biofuels.
In Iowa, for example, we have quite a few ethanol production facilities, and the Silurian Devonian Aquifer, and even more so the Cambrian Ordovician Aquifer, it's called the Jordan Aquifer, has been pumped down 150 or 200 feet. So eventually you won't be, future generations wouldn't be able to use that aquifer. It does recharge, but it recharges over a much longer time scale than would be of interest to our commerce and humans.
Those comments from Professor Schnorr, that's what he said. But then President Pro Tem at the Regents level sent that email asking that the biofuels people be allowed to provide some information to Professor Schnorr about that. And that now is raising questions of interference in academia, which shouldn't be there, Tim. How are you seeing that? Is that interfering with academic freedom?
I don't think so, that even Professor Schnorr if I'm pronouncing that correctly, in some comments that I read in the paper, indicated that he didn't think it was either and would certainly be happy to talk to the representatives of the industry and talk more about his research, whatever it happens to be. And that's what it should be. And sometimes that academics do get into controversial areas, or somebody that's, you know, sort of a practical expert in the field would like to contest the findings, and certainly you want to have those conversations. The email that I saw from Rassiter is basically, you know, I'd like to provide this information. Is there a way to do it? Certainly, he could have contacted the professor directly. That might have seemed more intimidating, I suppose. And, you know, other people in, as part of this story maybe could have found a better way to do it rather than sort of official channels of somebody on the Board of Regents and through the president, that just this industry representative should have just contacted the professor directly. But there didn't seem to be any indication that there was, oh, we're going to shut this guy down, or there's going to be a punishment of any sort here.
How are you reading this, Bruce? Kind of define for those in our audience who wonder, what is this academic freedom and everybody getting all tight about academic freedom? You can't criticize anybody at the university?
You can go right ahead and criticize anybody at the university you want, except for Tim. But, you know, I think the issue of academic freedom is badly stated, because it sounds like a badly termed, because it sounds like it's part of the Bill of Rights or something like that. And I think the issue is rather, I mean, Schnur has been active in environmental research for years. He spoke at Cohen, I think, 1996 or something like that. He knows what he's talking about. He has a great deal of research background and information and things like that. So the question is he allowed to research, draw conclusions based on that research, or will there be muscle applied to shape his findings in some way?
We're going to have to leave it there. Bruce Nesmith from Cole College, Tim Hagel from the University of Iowa, Emily Woodbury produced today's program. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. I'm Dean Borg, and this is a production of Iowa Public Radio.